Done, thank you.
Okay. Yes, so my mum died recently and I wanted to share some reflections I'd had about death. But first of all, maybe just say a few words about my mum. So she had an unusual life. She grew up in South Africa, met my dad in London. I was born in London. But in 1965, the whole family moved out to the newly independent Zambia, which is where my dad had grown up. And my parents lived there until they died. So they spent, well, my mum spent the vast majority of her life in Africa, most of it in Zambia. And she was a very keen amateur artist, and she was very involved in the Zambian art scene. And she actually got an MBE for her work with Zambian art, given to her by the Queen. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, she had an unusual life, but I'm not really here to talk about my mum as such. She had an unusual life, but she had a pretty ordinary death. Nor am I here to talk about my own feelings of loss, pain, loneliness, after her death. I mean, I've had a lot to process. I'm sure anybody who's been through the loss of a parent or both parents knows what I'm talking about. But that's not really what I want to talk about on this occasion. I want to talk more about death itself. So if we think about death, well, almost as soon as human beings were aware, self-conscious, they must have started thinking about death. So ideas about the afterlife are many and varied and go back a very long way. So the ancient Egyptians, you know, thousands of years ago, believed that at least if you did the right things, if you mummified the body, if you had your heart weighed on the scales after death, you might have an eternal afterlife of some kind. The ancient Greeks had a slightly shadowier idea. So they had the underworld, Hades, and everyone after death was supposed to go across the river Styx to Hades, where it's sort of a little bit unclear quite what sort of status you had. You sort of had a life, but not as we know it, you know, a life sort of devoid of the normal pleasures, except maybe talking to your contemporaries about the past. And of course, Christians and Muslims believe in eternal heaven or hell. And okay, you know, there might be an in-between state, purgatory, but eventually you come out of that, and for the rest of time, you're in heaven or in hell. In Hinduism, there's a belief in reincarnation. It's a bit different from the Buddhist idea. So reincarnation is the essence, the soul, the eternal self, as it were, plucked out of one body and popped into another, coming back in another body. Buddhists talk about rebirth, and rebirth is conceptually a little different. So in Buddhism, there's no idea that there is such a thing as an eternal sort of principle that doesn't change within us. But there is a suggestion that out of the actions, out of the way we've lived our lives, we condition our next life. More recently, there's been a lot of work done on near-death experiences. Now, I know this isn't quite the same thing. As far as I know, no one has come back long after death to tell us what it's about. But in near-death, you know, there are people who've been clinically dead for a few minutes. They're on the operating table. You know, the doctors are desperately trying to bring them back. And when they come back, some people remember having had certain experiences. But it seems that those experiences are quite varied. And there's a whole sort of academic study now of near-death experiences. And the suggestion I read is that they're culturally conditioned so that, you know, depending on your beliefs that you already have, there's some evidence that that conditions the way that you experience a near-death. But some people say that they've met their relatives on the other side. Some people say they've met disembodied beings of light or angels or spirits who maybe tell them that they haven't quite finished with this life and they need to go back and complete this life before they leave again. So there's a lot of different ways of looking at what happens after death, you know, throughout history. And while they can't all be true, there may be some truth in all of them. In other words, we have experiences, we give a certain status to our experience, which may not be fully justified. So I don't know how many of you know, but there's this story in Eastern tradition of the blind men and the elephant. So blind men are asked to approach an elephant and say what they experience. So the one who gets the ear says, oh, it's a winnowing basket, you know, and so on. They all say something different. The one who gets the tail says, it seems to be a brush of some kind. So it's not that they're wrong, but their experience is very partial. So it may be like that with near-death experiences. It may be like that with the different traditions that tell us what the afterlife is like. But anyway, what I really wanted to talk about was my experience of my mother's death. So it's the first time that I've been present when somebody actually died. And I found that, well, it was very interesting. I mean, obviously it's quite dramatic. And it didn't really fit any of the things that I'd heard about to do with death and what happens next. So my mum was 93. She was actually doing pretty well. She was out in Africa. I'd seen her fairly recently, last summer. And then she had a fall. And it wasn't completely clear initially how bad the fall was. She was taken to hospital. They did various tests. And eventually, they found that she'd cracked a vertebra in her neck. And because of that, she'd lost some movement on the right side of her body. Something seemed to be pressing on the spinal cord. It wasn't 100%, but she didn't have much movement left in her right arm and leg. However, in the hospital, once they'd found out what was going on, they were fairly confident that she could recover, that she would live, and that she might recover most of her movement. I had a talk with a local physiotherapist who said, no, there is some movement there. And, you know, over time, we can probably get her at least to the stage where she could walk with a walking frame or something like that. So she was discharged from the hospital. She came home. And we had borrowed a proper hospital-style bed for her because she had a neck brace, she couldn't move around. And we hired a nurse, or through an agency, so it was 24 hours, you know, the nurse had shifted. And they came with one of those sort of hospital-type monitors and wired her up so they could monitor her vital signs. But she'd come home to recover. And she was up and down, she had her good moments and bad. She wasn't a very good patient. I think she was too used to controlling things. I kept saying to her, you have to listen to the nurse. The nurse is the boss now. Refusing to take her medicine because it didn't taste nice and so on. But, you know, she was there. She was, at least some of the time, all there. And I was staying in the house because I was visiting by then. And one night, a few days after she got home, I woke up in the night and I did have a voice in my head saying the patient is dying. But, you know, you wake up at 2 in the morning and you're kind of like, oh, maybe it's a dream or, you know. why wouldn't your mind unconsciously be on that? But before I'd gone back to sleep again, the nurse came and knocked on the door and said, I think we need to call the ambulance. So I said, fine, if you think that, just call them. And as quickly as I could, I got dressed. I came out. Because this hospital, the bed was very large, my mum was in the living room. And it was like a little mini hospital. And when I came out, I went over beside the bed. My mum was completely silent. But the monitor, whereas during the day her blood oxygen had been around the 90 level, which is fine, it was already down to 60 and it was dropping. And while I was sitting there, I could see, you know, the vital signs going down, 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 and then flatline. And I remember saying to the nurse, she's gone, hasn't she? And that was it. You know, she didn't struggle. She didn't struggle for breath. She seemed to be in her sleep or unconscious. And she just very quietly went. But what struck me was how final it is. I mean, there was no point at that point in trying to get her to come back. In fact, she said to me, why don't they just let me go? You know, she was 93, and I think she felt at that stage of life, in a way, what's the point of a long, hard recovery? But it was very final in the sense that it's like an on-off switch. You know, one moment, even when I got there, there's a sort of sense of someone's presence, even though the vital signs were dropping. And then suddenly, there's a sense that they've gone. So that was, you know, the objective experience that I had of her death. Quite soon afterwards, a Buddhist friend of mine sent me a note. I told them that my mum had died. And, well, everything is impermanent. And of course it is. But when I got that message from them, I thought, yes, but this isn't impermanent like most other things are. So even, you know, even talking just about the time of death, I mean, you can see the body, you can see the impermanence at work, as it were. You know, the feet get cold first, the rest of the body's still warm. You know, the person doesn't go into rigor mortis straight away. And most of our experience of impermanence seems to be like that. You know, we don't always notice it, but every time we look in the mirror, there's another grey hair, another wrinkle, whatever it is. We certainly see it with our friends, you know. We haven't seen them for a few months and we see them again. Oh, you know, they're a bit older, aren't they? So, most of the time, our experience of impermanence is like that. It's bit by bit, isn't it? So that really struck me about death, is that it's very final, and when it happens, it's what I thought of it is as binary. It's like on-off. You know, there isn't an in-between. I mean, I know, you know, you can be dying, but at that point where you actually die, you don't do it by half measures, do you? You die. And that is it. So I found that in itself quite curious, that impermanence didn't quite fit my experience. It's not that it wasn't impermanent, of course it was. But that wasn't sort of a precise enough way of looking at death to me. So I thought about it some more, and I think, okay, that might fit the material body. But when you're talking about the mind, when you're talking about consciousness, you need a sort of more precise way. What would explain that kind of binary, on-off, final kind of experience? And I thought, well, okay, that's more like no self. You know, there's something in that area. Buddhism says that we don't have... It's not just that we don't have a permanent self, but the way we normally think of ourselves is not really accurate. You know, psychologically, we have sort of partial selves, but it's much more than that. You know, we know that we would not exist without the millions of microbes in our stomach. Are they, you know, is that microbe me? It's complex. We are very complex beings. And it's very difficult to say within that complexity, this is me, that is not me. So I thought it's something in that area. So then I thought of what's behind. So Buddhism says that there are three characteristics of existence. That it's impermanent, that there is not only in us but in all things the idea that there is a self, a thing, is really an illusion. And it's unsatisfactory because, you know, we would rather it was permanent, we would rather things were fixed in the way we want them to be, and they're not. But behind that is the idea of dependent arising. So there's a kind of principle at work through everything. And just to read out one of the classic examples given. So it's this being that becomes. From the arising of this, that arises. This not being that does not become. From the ceasing of this, or from the cessation of this, that ceases. So I thought, yes, that's an explanation, a much more precise explanation of what I had felt. So there was something which had ceased, and with the cessation of whatever bodily function it was, however you like to look at that, that particular experience of presence, of consciousness, had also ceased. So one thing was dependent on the other. Whatever was going on, it's not to say that they're the same, but whatever it is within us that sustains consciousness and awareness and life, when those conditions are taken away, it is not possible to sustain that within that individual any longer. But yes, that is a sort of explanation, but it doesn't say what status consciousness then has. And it's very salutary to take stock sometimes of what we actually know, rather than what we've heard or what we've read. So I remember Sangharakshita saying this, you might remember which lecture it is, it's in the introduction to one of his lectures. He says it's very salutary to do that, and if we did that, if we made a list of the things that we really know from our own experience, disregarding what we've heard and believe, or read and believe, it would be a very short list. So most of what we know or accept or believe, you know, it's information, isn't it, that we receive, and we don't necessarily have any reason to disbelieve it, so we accept it. But I don't think anybody scientifically really understands consciousness. There's lots of opinions, lots of ideas about it. And I think really that applies to life as well. So if you look at sort of theories of evolution, they, you know, again, they can tell you quite a lot. But that point, yes, you need a certain type of amino acids, etc., etc. But what constitutes life, I don't think has ever quite been explained. And the same with consciousness. Yes, you need a being of a certain complexity to have a certain level of consciousness and self-awareness. But why that should exist in that being, I don't think has ever really been explained. And it's quite good to know that, because it kind of pushes you into a different area. I mean, a lot of the time we want to know things, don't we? Because that's our security is tied up with that. Our feeling of well-being is tied up with feeling that we know what's going on. But in the open nature of being, it's actually very difficult to pin things down. And Padmasambhava famously said to his disciples that they should repeat to themselves again and again, I do not have, I do not know, I do not understand. So he's talking to very advanced Buddhist practitioners, you know, people with a lot more experience of meditation and potentially insight than we do. And he's still telling them, no, remind yourself, you don't really know. So life is a mystery, consciousness is a mystery. What we can do is look at what the Buddha says, what the Buddhist tradition says, to kind of fill in, as I've done, you know, reflecting on some of the things that I'd learned, heard about life. And of course, the Buddhist tradition, going right back to the Buddha, has always accepted the idea of rebirth. In fact, some of the earliest descriptions of the Buddha's enlightenment experience consist of him reviewing in meditation hundreds and thousands of rebirths of his own over endless time, and seeing how the way he'd acted in one life led to the type of life that he had next. So it's from reviewing that experience that he came to understand dependent arising. So, you know, we can go back, we may not have knowledge, but we can have faith in the Buddha's teaching. We can go back to that. We can think, okay, I don't know for myself what happens, but this is what the Buddha said, this is what the Buddhist tradition said. But then how does that relate to the Buddha's death, the Parinirvana, that we're celebrating today? Well, the Buddha was asked, apparently during his lifetime, at least it's there in the ancient texts, that he was asked, what is the status of an enlightened being after the death of their physical body? So before he died, he was already being asked this question. And in typically thorough Indian logical fashion, people wanted to know whether an enlightened being still exists after death, whether they do not exist after death, whether they both exist and don't exist after death, or whether they neither exist or not exist after death. So, you know, you can see in a way that the human mind is struggling to cover all the options and find out, you know, which one's right. And the Buddha said they're all unanswerable questions. There are a number of other unanswerable questions, like when he was asked whether the universe is finite or infinite. So there seemed to be a level of enlightenment experience which is so different from our own that the way that we pose the questions makes them unanswerable. So I think, you know, my sense that my mum's death, that the parting of her body and her consciousness was a mystery, is even more the case with the Buddha, with an enlightened being. It is one of the great mysteries. The Buddha said it can't be answered on that level. You can only experience it. And I think what I'm getting at is that when we look at death as a mystery, what it throws up is that life itself is actually a mystery. We don't know why we're here. We just about know that we are here, at least some of the time we know that. And if we reflect on it, we could be dead. Well, we will be. We heard that earlier on. We will be. We don't know when, you know, maybe sometime, maybe a short time, maybe a long time. But worse than knowing that we're going to die is the thought that if we're not alive to the mystery of being alive, we might as well be dead. So you know, in that not knowing, in a way we're being pointed back towards direct experience, towards trying to find a deeper point within ourselves, where we first of all at least touch on the fact that we're alive, that we touch on the fact that we're self-conscious, that we're self-aware, and then maybe even go beyond that to have some deeper experience, what in Buddhism is called insight, into the broader nature of all life and everything that exists. And that's what I want to leave you with.
Great, thank you very much, Kiva Mitra. That's very thought-provoking. Okay, so how are we doing?